Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the things that we got going on over there. Hey, there's a new site. Have you been to it? Have you checked it out? The new 1517 site, where all the things that 1517 does are, but also all the things that Christ Hold Fast does are, and all the things that Chad Bird does are, all in that same big resource hub. You should go over there and check it out. You can go to 1517.org, or if you go to ChristHoldFast.org or Chad Bird, any of those places will take you to that site. You can go to the different sections. Also, if you want to hang out with Chad and myself and a whole bunch of other people, you can. There's still, I think, around 40 tickets left to the Here We Still Stand conference in October. Go over to HereWeStillStand.org and get all the information. And if you want to get a little bit of a discount, you can enter the promo code PNET19 in the promo box and get $25 off your ticket because you're listening to this podcast. Chad, what's going on in the wonderful book of Deuteronomy?
We got some weird stuff coming up, I'll be honest.
We do.
We got like everything from, making a captive woman your wife, to dealing with two wives, to what do you do if you have a stubborn, rebellious son, to taking a body down that you hung up on a tree, to bringing your neighbor's lost donkey home, and women not wearing men's clothes and men not wearing women's clothes. How's that sound for a lead-in?
Hey, you know what? These are everyday issues that we need to get answers to.
I know there's a lot of guys wondering what they should do about, whether they should marry the captive that they have. So it's a pressing concern.
It is. I'm glad that God has some very clear instructions on this.
Yeah. So we are in the middle of chapter 21 of Deuteronomy. And there is, the rest of this chapter, chapter 22, chapter 23. I mean, we've got a lot of stuff that is interesting. From, just a kind of a biblical perspective. It's got some New Testament connections too, which we'll bring up later in this chapter. When I was looking through this, preparing for the podcast, I kept saying to myself, you just got to put yourself in a completely different place. I don't care where you're at in the world. You're not living in this culture.
Yeah. Well, I think it's passages like this that remind you that the Bible is written in a different time and place. Some people will say like every word of the Bible is relevant today. It's not all equally relevant. We'll put it that way. There are things in the Bible where you are like, okay, it's tough to find a place in modern life where this is applicable. And it reminds you that this is just different and it's speaking to a different culture. Now there's obviously loads and loads of stuff that's very applicable and very relevant. But it's not all equally applicable and relevant.
Yeah, I think we can draw out kind of general truths from these specific examples and see some applicability there, like do nice things for your neighbor and treat people well and those sorts of things. Those are sort of the love of your neighbors yourself, of course, is undergirding all these laws. So that remains everlastingly applicable. But these specific examples, these are things that we're just not going to encounter. But for the Israelites, this was, these weren't like occasional incidents that might happen. This was stuff that was a very realistic possibility.
Yeah.
Like starting out in verse 10, you're a soldier and you go off to war. And what happens in war? Well, if you conquer a city, at least a city outside the Holy Land, then typically all the enemy guys are put to death, but you take captive the women and children. Well, what are you going to do with them? And the situation that's presented here in Deuteronomy 21:10 through 14 is, all right, you've conquered a city, and you're bringing back the women and the children, the captives. And lo and behold, you see one of these women and she's super attractive. And you say to yourself, rather than making her into a servant, I think I'm just going to marry her. You put yourself back in that situation and you could definitely see that happening, right? What do you do in that situation? So this is one of these examples where, and the Bible does this a lot, like it takes existing practices, and rather than simply forbidding them, what it will often do is just kind of place boundaries around those existing practices. We saw this in the case of the asylum cities, right? It doesn't forbid a surviving relative from seeking revenge against someone who either accidentally or purposely killed his brother or his father or whoever. It doesn't forbid that cultural practice, but it does place limits on it. And it's kind of the situation here. So you get this soldier, he sees this beautiful woman among the captives, and he decides that he wants to make her his wife. So what do you do in that situation? Well, according to Deuteronomy 21, after he gets her back to his community, then she's given 1 month of mourning. And what 30 days was a typical mourning time for the Israelites. We have examples of that in the scriptures. And during this time, it says that she shaves her head, she trims her nails, she takes off her clothing of captivity. So presumably somehow connected with mourning rituals. And then after that time, then he can take her as his wife. And this happened all the time in the ancient world. This was not just like an Israelite thing. We have plenty of examples from antiquity where things such as this happen. Okay, so it kind of assumes that that is going to be something that's going to go down. But here's the situation. So what happens if later on, the attractiveness of her beauty, which, you know, lured him in to begin with, is not enough to sustain his interest. And he's like, he's not pleased with her anymore. He doesn't want her to be his wife anymore. Then what's he going to do with her? Well, verse 14 says that he basically has to liberate her, just to let her go. But here's what he can't do. He can't decide that because he doesn't like her now, doesn't want to be married to her anymore, that he can turn around and sell her as a slave to someone. It says that is forbidden. So he shall not mistreat her because he has humbled her. So that's the law. It's to us, yeah. I mean, I'm steeped in the Old Testament, but I'm reading this. I'm like, well, that's really strange. But that's just the way it was.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way to read that in our society and not be like, it's a little misogynistic. This, like, yeah. Doesn't seem like she has a lot of say in this. I mean, captive women is just not so. I mean, there's no way around that. And it is just dealing with the way that society was structured. It's better that this is not a scenario that we have to deal with now. And if we did see, if we saw another country where this scenario was always happening, we'd be like, dude, something's got to change over there. Like, that's
messed up.
That's messed up. And so what it's doing is, yeah, it's great that you can't sell her to be a slave and all that kind of stuff. And the reason you have to take the women is because they don't have any options. Like, they're going to all die. That's part of the misogyny of the culture, is that, what are you going to do? You can't go get a job over here or over there at the, you know, some other, you know, you can't go to med school or whatever, what are you going to do? And so there's layers to the reasons that this is the way it is. It is good that that's no longer the way it is.
Yeah. Well put. Well, so that's the first scenario. We got some more coming up here too. So,
all right.
Let's see what we got next. So verse 15 starts out with a kind of interesting phrase. If a man has two wives. So we've discussed this before, the subject of polygamy. So this is a case where, notice it doesn't say a man shall not have two wives, or cursed be the man who has two wives. It just says if a man has two wives, because as we've seen multiple places in the Old Testament, this was not uncommon whatsoever.
This seems very normal, actually.
Seems very normal. Yeah, I mean, I think part of the issue, we know the stories from like Genesis so well that I think sometimes we just don't stop to think about how strange this is. Like, Abraham had more than one wife, and Jacob had more than one wife, and we have, of course, all the kings had not just two or three, but a whole lot of wives. So polygamy was by no means unusual in the Old Testament. And this is one more case where we got a situation here, and the situation is not polygamy per se. but it's okay. You've got two wives, and the situation is that one is loved and one is not. Well, that ought to sound familiar. Of course, that's Jacob all over again, because Rachel he loves and Leah he doesn't. So if you got one loved and one unloved, and the firstborn son comes from the unloved wife, and then later on other sons are born to the wife who's loved. Well, the husband might be tempted to say, you know what, I really love you know wife B more than wife A. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give my inheritance over to the firstborn son of wife B, the one that I really love.
Yeah, and this is something you could totally see Jacob doing. It's all like, where he's like, Joseph and Benjamin get all the stuff.
Yeah. Knowing Jacob, yeah, he'd be like, in fact, I sometimes wonder if this law was not given specifically with Jacob in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you could, yeah. Well, not just that, but the wife herself could try and use her influence. You know, I know that, you know, little Eli over there is the firstborn, but you know, look at my little Samuel. You know, he's a much better kid, and you love me more, and thus you love Samuel more. So why don't you give the inheritance to him?
Because Eli is probably just going to end up like his mother.
Oh yeah, yeah, you know he's going to. You get to see this pillow talk going on, right? These conversations going on. But see, so here's the rule, because that is a very real possibility. Then the rule is, nope, that can't happen. So whoever the firstborn is, it doesn't matter which wife he comes from. That firstborn is the firstborn, will remain the firstborn. And so he's going to be the one who probably will inherit twice what the other sons will. That's typical inheritance for the firstborn. So this is trying to, as much as it can, put a barrier in the way of someone acting simply out of selfish interest, instead of saying, well, you know what, God's gift was God's action was giving us this particular firstborn son. And so he's the one who's the primogenitor. Thus, he's the one who's going to receive the inheritance. That's the second situation where you have a polygamous household, multiple sons. Who's going to receive the inheritance? All right. Now we're going to shift into a little bit more dicey territory next, 18 and following. I don't know that this ever happened in the life of Israel. Maybe it did. We don't have any instances actually recorded this happened, but so this is another case where we're dealing with a son, but this is a different situation because we have a stubborn and rebellious son. It says he won't obey his father or his mother, and they discipline him. It says they chastise him. And no matter what they do, he doesn't listen to them. Well, it says if that's the case, then mom and dad are supposed to take their son and bring him out to the elders of the city at the gateway of the hometown. Of course, the gateway, the entrance to the city was like where court was held, kind of unofficial and official discussions and debates and hearings and judgments were made there at the gate of the city. That was like the official place, kind of like the courthouse, I guess. So they bring him there and they tell the elders this. They say, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard, which I think that's like sort of a saying, like that was kind of language they used to describe a son who was like this. So that's the way he is. He won't obey us. Well, verse 21 says, then all the men of the city shall stone him to death. So you shall remove the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear of it and fear. This is a hard one to wrap your mind around. How do you deal with a stubborn and rebellious son today? Well, I mean, I guess you do a lot of the same things that they would have done back then. I mean, you discipline him, you straight and narrow and stop him from making disastrous decisions or from committing crimes or whatever it might be, but you don't take him to the courthouse and say, execute him.
No.
Because he won't listen to us.
No, it's not typically how that goes.
It doesn't work. So it's a strange scenario, but I was reading Luther's commentary on Deuteronomy on this particular section, and I thought he had a good point. I mean, this is as extreme as this is. If nothing else, this impresses upon us just how foundational for the life of Israel, the fourth commandment was to honor your father and your mother. I mean, that really, that is, that's kind of the, that's the foundational commandment for, at least in the Israelite sense of the law, that's the foundational commandment for what we call the second table of law, where we life with our neighbors. So if you have a child who won't listen to his father and mother, chances are he's going to be a menace to society, because those are kind of, that's the foundational family relationship that determines how the children are going to conduct themselves. So
yeah, it seems that the idea here is that, you know, if they come and they say, look, like, we've tried all these things, like, he won't listen to us. So you have this son who is apparently going to be a problem for the entire community. Because I don't think this is talking about, I mean, when they say a glutton and a drunkard, so we're not talking about like a 5 year or 6 year old kid or something like that. This seems like this is a teenager or something. And apparently.
Sounds like a teenager.
Yeah, sounds like a teenager. Totally does. I'm sure that we'd all be like, well, I guess I would have got killed in Israel. But it seems that the idea here is that this is a someone who is not who doesn't give a rip about, you know, what God has said, doesn't care about how Israel is to conduct itself. And they're like, yeah, he's going to be a problem going forward. And so they just root it out. And that's a crazy thing. And it's difficult to get your head around, for sure. It does also tell you that how serious God is about sin too, that we know, and we've said before, that the wages of sin is death. And this is an example of, well, I said, honor your father and mother, you don't, and this is how this works. It's not that we should go around then stoning our kids, but it does tell us that the consequences of sin is death. And and we know this ultimately at the cross.
Now, what's fascinating about this section is how it segues into what's coming next.
Yeah.
So kind of keep that in mind about a stubborn, rebellious son who's accused of being a glutton and a drunkard. So kind of keep that in the back of your mind. And then listen to, I'm just going to read these next two verses. This is chapter 21, verses 22 and 23. If a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his corpse shall not hang all night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him on the same day. For he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not, that was in parentheses, he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. The reason this is fascinating is we transition from this discussion about this son who's stubborn, rebellious, glutton and a drunkard, and put to death, to, okay, yeah, how do you deal with a body, right? So you got this body that he's been, I mean, stoning was a typical way in which people were executed in Israel. So presumably he's been stoned, but as sometimes happen, and we have cases like, we'll see these when we get to Joshua, where Joshua like executed some foreign kings and then hung up their bodies for part of a day and then buried them that same day in the evening. So this was like a kind of a public display kind of deal. They weren't like, this wasn't crucifixion, but this was a display of the body on a tree on wood. So if that happens, he's executed and you put him up on this tree, you hang him on a tree, then you don't leave the corpse there all night. You bury him the same day because the one who's hanged is accursed of God. So what's fascinating, again, is when you look at this in the light of Galatians, right?
Yeah.
Because let me read you this section from Galatians chapter 3. This is 3:10 and following. Paul is saying that as many as are of the works of the law are under a curse, because it's written, cursed is everyone who does not abide by all the things written in the book of the law to perform them. Okay. Now that no one is justified by the law before God is evident, because the righteous shall live by faith. However, the law is not of faith. On the contrary, he who practices them shall live by them. And here's verse 13. This is the one that's key. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. In order that in Christ Jesus, the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles, so that we who receive the promise of the Spirit through, we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. So Paul's talking about how the ones who don't do the law are under a curse. because of course the law is constantly pronouncing a curse upon those who break it. And then he says, Christ, for this reason, Christ became a curse for us. And then of all the things he could have quoted, he pulls this verse out of Deuteronomy 21 that we just read and says, for as it is written, cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree. It seems to me that what Paul is doing here is he's reading not just that particular verse in Deuteronomy 21, but he's reading that whole context. So there's this talk of a stubborn, rebellious son who's put to death, accused of being a glutton and a drunkard, and then a body hung on a tree, and that body is cursed by God hanging on that tree. And Paul, in this masterful exegesis, he interprets this whole section in light of Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's when you look at exactly how Paul does this kind of interpretation, where he'll pull the Old Testament verse from, and you look at the whole context, all of a sudden this whole section has a completely new meaning for me, because you can see how, of course, Christ is accused of being a glutton and a drunkard, mm-hmm. right? And he's accused of being rebellious, and he is put to death. Even though he's a faithful and obedient son, he's still put to death. And then his body's hung on a tree, and he's accursed of God. And all of this in order that he might become the curse for us, in order that we might become, as Paul says, part of Abraham's offspring. Now we are like the sons and the daughters of Abraham. When you put all that together, it's amazing to me just the way that Paul sees all of this as interconnected.
Yeah, I mean, like this whole chapter is you read it and you're like, man, this is pretty messed up. And it's dealing with messed up things in the sense that, like, well, this is going to happen because you're a bunch of sinners. This is going to happen because you're a bunch of sinners. And here's the other thing that sinners do. And like, so here's all these situations, and you're reading it and you're like, well, this is all horrible. And it ends with this. And then also, you know, cursed people, you know, if someone's hung on a tree, that person's cursed by God. And yeah, so I 100% think that Paul pulls that and says, like, you know, all that, like, messed up stuff, like, what you're going to need is someone to be cursed for all these things, somebody to have all these things laid upon them, because this whole section is full of just undesirable situations. That none of this stuff is good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a great example of just how necessary it is to, when you're reading whatever in the Old Testament, to read it always with one eye on Christ. Yeah, so one eye on Deuteronomy 21, one eye on Christ, because Paul shows us in one way or another, it all is going to come to its fulfillment in him. And this is a great example of that. So he becomes everything that we deserve. He becomes the curse, or as Paul says in 1 Corinthians, that he who knew no sin became sin for us. So however you want to say it, that he became a curse or he became sin for us, that's what's happening here. All of this just crazy, messed up stuff that's talked about in Deuteronomy and elsewhere, all of that evil and injustice finally is brought to its head in Christ. And it's because of him that we have hope, because in him we have the blessing, because he came the curse for us.
Yeah, yeah. Deuteronomy 21 it zooms in on a world that desperately needs redemption, and ends with a verse that Paul quotes in conjunction with that redemption. So I think that's kind of what's going on there.
Yeah, yeah. So some good stuff there when you see it in light of Galatians. Okay, well let's keep rocking along here. We're at the end of 21, so we'll jump here into 22. And the first four verses echo some of the material that we've seen elsewhere. It's a concern, basically, it's a double concern. It's a concern for your neighbor, but it's also a concern for your neighbor's property. In this case, your neighbor's livestock. So more or less, if you're outside and all of a sudden an ox or a sheep comes wandering up, or you find them when you're out in the field, and you wonder what to do with them. Well, here's what you do. Well, you first of all, if you know whose it is, you return the property. So finders keepers does not apply in the Old Testament. It's not the way it works, because you are to view your neighbor's property as your own responsibility in the sense that if he loses something, then you take it back to him. And it says that, you know, suppose you find an animal and you don't know whose it is. Well, it says, if that's the case, you take it to your house and it stays with you until he comes looking for it. And then you give it back to him. And he says, not only does this apply to animals, but it's the same thing. Like if he loses one of his garments or loses anything, then you are to take care of it until he comes looking for it. And you're not to basically turn a blind eye to your neighbor's needs, to your neighbor's property. This is a specific illustration of love your neighbor as yourself. So this is, how do you love your neighbor? Well, this is one example. You return his lost property, or you take care of his lost property until he comes looking for it. And if you see that maybe his ox or his donkey has fallen down under some burden, then you help him raise it up. So these are just like concrete, specific examples of how you love your neighbor. So love, of course, is not just some kind of emotion or some kind of wish, but here love is incarnate in the sense that it's going to be evident in the actions you show toward your neighbor. So I don't know if there's anything else to say about those four verses, but that's the way this opens up. Now, the next, I guess, seven verses, five through 12, deal with some related things. A lot of these are similar in nature, in the sense they deal with not mixing up, some of them anyway, deal with not mixing up stuff that doesn't belong. So verse 5 starts out with what I referenced at the beginning of the podcast. A woman shall not wear man's clothing, nor shall a man put on woman's clothing. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God. And I think the concern here, well, of course, first of all, this is another one of these where you got to put yourself back in that society where people did not dress similarly. So if you saw a guy, you knew just from his clothing that was a guy. If you saw a girl, you knew from her clothing that was a girl. So the basic idea here is that whatever God has created you to be, and however you conduct yourself and however you dress yourself, then that's a representation of who you are. So don't try and masquerade yourself as something that God has not created you to be. That's verse 5. Verse 6 has this is another one of these kind of concern for not just your neighbor, but the concern for your neighbor actually also involves concern for creation itself. So this is one of probably, I don't know, maybe three or four examples in the Old Testament where there's actually a concern for the proper treatment of animals, which interestingly, I don't know if we have this in Christianity, but in Judaism, there's a whole ethical system that revolves around the proper ethical treatment of animals. I mean, even down to how you should, if you're like going to butcher beef, there's a certain way that you can, that they're supposed to put the animal to death before the meat is taken from them. So this is one of these cases. So verse 6 says, if you happen to come upon a bird's nest in a tree or on the ground, and there's young ones or eggs, and the mother sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall certainly let the mother go, but the young you may take for yourself in order that it may be well with you and that you may prolong your days. So there is this, we don't hear, I don't think I've ever heard anywhere in any sermon, a kind of a reference to the proper treatment of animals. But even though it's not a big deal in the Bible, it is there. So animals are not to be treated simply as that we can do with them whatever the hell we want to. I mean, there is a concern even for the proper treatment of animals in the Old Testament. And this is one of those examples. There's, as I said, there's three or four others as well. Continues 8 says, when you build a house, and all the houses back then had flat roofs, and a lot of time was spent up on the roof. I mean, they dried out things there. They slept there during hot weather. We even have in the New Testament this idea of like people preaching or crying out from the rooftops. Well, that's because the rooftops were flat, and so there was a lot of activity that happened up there. You know, we have our back porches. They had their roofs. And so you, but if there's no guard, if there's no parapet along the edge to prevent someone from falling, well, then you've heightened the risk factor of them being up there. So it's a simple concern. If you build a new house and you're finishing your roof, you put a parapet around the roof. So this small wall, if you will, to prevent someone from stumbling off. And the concern is that you not bring blood guilt on your house if anyone falls from it. In other words, don't create a situation or don't allow a situation to exist in which a person could become hurt, injured, even die. Arrange your home, arrange your property, arrange your activities in such a way that you don't create a situation where a member of your own family or one of your neighbors can become harmed. It's kind of the same idea behind if you have an animal, maybe it's an ox that is very dangerous and is likely to harm someone, then you yourself as the owner are held responsible for that. So it's a concern that in all your doings and all your property that you do, you conduct things in such a way that the risk of harm is reduced to people. And then 9, 10, 11, and 12, all concern not mixing things. Like you don't, in your vineyard, you don't sow two kinds of seed when you plow. I know, Dan, this is a verse that you think a lot about.
Yeah, yeah, I do.
When you take care of your farm. I mean, I know you have an ox and a donkey, and the temptation when you plow is to put both of them together. But we've talked about this before. You gotta stop that.
Yeah, I don't do that anymore. That used to be my go-to, but yeah, I've amended my ways.
Well, I'm glad to see you're increasing your sanctification. Mm-hmm. I knew it would happen. So that's forbidden. No wearing a material that's mixed wool and linen together.
Yeah, I've just gotten rid of the wool. Period. Just so
you're just going linen now.
Yeah, so I'm not tempted. I don't want to be tempted.
Oh, good man, you're getting this law down.
Yeah,
we can get some tassels on the four corners of your garments.
It is hard to read this stuff and not be like, okay, like I don't know, man. And here's the thing: while it would seem ridiculous, right, where you're like, okay. Say me and Chad like went in on a vineyard. Okay, we decided, you know what? Let's like start growing these grapes, and we're gonna release that 40 minute wine. You know, we're gonna do that. It's gonna be great. But we gotta like, you know, it comes time to like plant some new vines. Now, obviously we're not going to be like, shoot, now let's make sure we don't plant two different kinds of grapes in here. It's two different, you know, we don't have any mixed seeds in here. But if you did believe that we were still under the law in some way, then you do have to think about these things. You actually do have to think about, okay, is this wool and linen mixed in any way? Is that what's going on here? Like what's going on with this? You would literally have to put some tassels on all your shirts. That would also have to be, also based on other passages, a certain length. Even, I mean, like the shirt itself needs to be long, you know. You need to do all these things. And so when somebody, I mean, so like, while this is sort of, we read this and we're like, this seems ridiculous, these are all things to set Israel apart, obviously, from other nations. So like, you know, hey, I know that's an Israelite walking down the street without even asking. Like, I know for sure it is, because look at the way he's dressed, look at the way he looks. But if that person that comes to you and then says, well, you know, we still, you know, the law, and it's like throwing the law on you, you can't parse it all out and say that that this other stuff doesn't apply then.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But that's usually what happens.
Well, what they'll do is they'll say there's a ceremonial law, and then there's the moral law. And the moral law stands. Well, where does this fall in? Because
nice and neat categories we often hear about, they're a little bit too nice and neat.
Yeah, because these aren't ceremonial.
Yeah, where does it apply?
Well, this is moral. You know, making sure that you have a fence on the top of your house is not ceremonial.
Exactly.
Look at the reason that he says to do it. It's moral. This isn't the same as like ritual uncleanliness or anything like that. Like that's not these kind of, these are very practical laws. respect. I understand ceremonial law, like some of that stuff, but I think that there's stuff that's, there's a lot of gray area on some of these other things. You're like, well, I don't know, where does this fall in?
Yeah, so I understand. I mean, just for the sake of instruction, some people have divided into the three kinds of law, right? The political and the ritual and the moral. But there's those, yeah, as I say, those categories are fluid categories. And there's some things that, you know, it's hard to put them in any one of those three, or they cross over like the Sabbath does.
Well, typically what
happens, a lot of this stuff is, yeah, how do you conduct yourself morally, right? Taking the captive one and making your wife, right? Or a rebellious son. All this is moral law.
Well, typically what people will do is they will say, well, Ten Commandments, those are the ones that cross over. Oh, and also, you know, the sexuality stuff. Those are the, that's right. The only, that's what they want to take over. That's it.
It's a great example of how if you're going to live under the law, well, then you're going to have to live under the whole law. There's no like picking and choosing a few things that you think apply to you and the other ones don't apply to you, which is why the gospel is as sweet as it is, because we are rescued from the power of the law. Christ is the end of the law. And so now we live in freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that the law, I mean, like, it's certainly what always is bound to happen is when you say something like, well, you know, if you're gonna, the same God that said, thou shalt not covet said, put tassels on your garment. And you might think that's ridiculous, but that is true. If you go to, you know, Hebrew Roots movement kind of stuff, there are certain movements that like will acknowledge that this is the case. Although I would vehemently disagree with that, with them bringing all of this stuff over, at least they're consistent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think what they show, what groups like that show, is what happens when you go down that road.
Yeah.
If you want to go down the law road, then you're going to go all the way. There's no like going a few feet down the law road. It's either don't go down it or you're going to go all the way, because the law will, and the law has a way of sucking you in that way too, because it like proliferates. You start doing this and think you have to live under that. And then pretty soon you're living under 10 more things and then 100 more things. And pretty soon you put yourself back under the old covenant completely. And in Paul's words, and you've believed a different gospel, which is no gospel at all.
Yeah. Well, you also want the law, but you don't want the punishments either. So you want honor your father and mother, but you don't want to go stone your rebellious kids.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And that's it, man. That's a great way to end it.
Yeah, that's a real optimistic ending.
It's great. It's a great way to end it, guys.
We got more stuff coming up next week, so yeah. Stay tuned.
Yeah, we're going to have more super popular stuff to talk about next week. Hope you'll join us. Chad, I'll see you then.